It gives me great pleasure this evening to introduce my very dear, very old friend. Not so old, long time friend, Paul Krasner.
Thank you. Okay, all right. Don't overdo it now. Come on. So welcome to this meeting of the Christian Coalition. They just ended that conference today, and I watched as much of it as I could and read about it as much as I could. And I was able to finally crystallize what the message of the Christian Coalition was this weekend. And it was that if the Virgin Mary had an abortion, then there wouldn't be all those Republican candidates kissing their ass today. In whose name would they have gathered? My theory is that all religions, not just Christianity, any religion you can name, any cult, every single one of them has in common that it's a rationalization of the sex urge, and the orgasm in particular. And it's the only way that people can deal with it. You know, evolution doesn't answer that certain questions about, you know, the placement of nerve endings. And it's even atheism, which is a religion of itself in that it puts a lot of energy into not believing in an all-powerful deity. But, you know, but even atheists, it's an extension of the reproductive urge. And it's revealed at the moment of sexual climax, atheists, now you would think, you know, they believe they're the center of the universe and everything revolves around them, so you would think, okay, that's pretty megalomaniacal. What do? Do they call out their own names? So in the interest of scientific pursuit, I've slept with a few atheists. What they yell out at the moment of sexual climax is, no God. Totally consistent with the core of their philosophy.
I'd never seen a pillar of fire that tall.
So, I mean, even the Hare Krishnas, you know, it started out with just like six disciples who had previously derived their entire theology from celestial seasonings teabag boxes, who were now eavesdropping outside the tent of the wife of an impotent Hindu deity. And they misunderstood what she was saying and adopted it. What she was yelling out was, "Hurry, Krishna! Hurry, Krishna! Hurry, hurry! Ram it! Hurry, hurry! Ram it! Hurry, Krishna! Hurry, Krishna!" But, you know, it gets lost in the translation, and a whole big cult developed out of this, international. Every year on the Venice Boardwalk, they have their annual parade there with the elephant that's been fed entirely on trail mix. It's very inspiring.
Okay, Swami, or whatever your name is, we'll be back with this Christ Consciousness racket in just a minute.
No, Mr. Swaini. Krishna Consciousness, you see, to our people.
There is a new kind of tabloid newspaper on the stands these days. Some people call them the avant-garde press. Others, filthy, left-wing rags. Our guest is the editor of such a paper. It's called The Realist, and it's published in New York. Paul Krasner is a bright young man, but I fail to see why he feels it's necessary to have the most obscene four-letter word known to man in just about every issue. Do you suffer from a lack of vocabulary or just bad imagination?
Well, I don't think it's either, Joe. I fail to see why out of 30,000 words you choose to take one or two from each issue to underline.
To tell you the truth, I wouldn't recognize your paper if you didn't have them in there. Now, maybe that's why you have them in there.
Well, I think that anybody else can recognize it by the cover or by anything else. And if that's the only way you can recognize a publication, then you're going to get it confused with a lot of books that use the same words.
Hello, I'm Lara Ray, and you're listening to the Friday edition of The Current.
Which deodorant does Lyndon Johnson use? Now, what does that mean? What is that? Paul Krasner, what is that? Which deodorant does Lyndon Johnson use? That's your front page head.
Yes. Do you want to know which one? By brand name?
No, I want to know what is that? What is the reason for that?
Well, I think that the President of the United States is at such a height that people have
such
to...
Such a what?
A height.
height.
He's put on such a pedestal that people have to realize that he is only a human being and does use a deodorant. Like you and me.
From way back in 1967, that was Paul Krasner being grilled about an article that appeared in his satirical magazine, The Realist. And for more than half a century now, Paul Krasner, a co-founder with Abby Hoffman of the Youth International Party, or Yippies, has been using humor to raise political awareness about the issues he finds important. He's the author of numerous books, including one whose title really says it all about Paul Krasner, Confessions of a Raving, Unconfined Nut, Misadventures in the Counterculture. We've reached Paul Krasner in Palm Springs, California. Hello.
Hi, I'm glad to hear myself.
I'm glad to hear you, and I'm glad you're still around. You know that I've been a fan for decades, and that was a bit of a rough interview with Joe Pine back in 1967. What happened?
It was funny. But you know, in at that show, at one point, he asked really mean-spirited questions. And at one point, I said, okay, if you're going to ask questions like that, let me ask you, do you take off your wooden leg before you make love with your wife?
How did that go over?
Oh, he, you know, his jaw literally dropped. I mean, he was in the Marines in, I forget which war, but he lost his leg in the war. And he had 7 guns, I'd learned about him, and he slept with one under his pillow.
Oh, God.
And he just went nuts because the producers of the show said that they've never seen him so messed up by a simple thing that an interviewee said. So, you know, he was the predecessor to all of these mean-spirited, bullying hosts. Yeah.
That's what I love about your book, Paul. You know, I mean, it's all in there, Confessions of a Raving, Unconfined Nut. You know, I mean, you covered that whole period and it was so colorful.
I'm very happy you're here. It's my job is to make you laugh, and you've passed the test so far. But there are performers who get hostile when audiences don't laugh, and I don't take that approach. I think it's a matter of individual perception as a group, but there are things you should know about laughter, this process that we take so for granted that's a spontaneous act, because they've done research. They found out that when you laugh, you breathe in 6 times as much oxygen as normal breathing. So it's very good for your cardiovascular system. It's very good for your peristalsis. They found that 20 seconds of hearty laughter is equivalent to 20 minutes on a rowing machine. So see, look, if you don't laugh, it's your health. I don't care. They found that the most commonly used consonant in laughter is H. So you very rarely hear people laughing fa 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 or ka 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 ka. There are a few exceptions. So like if you're a sinister person, you might laugh with an M. Or Popeye the Sailor Man used to have a sort of a G with his laugh. I am what I am. Ka 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 ka. And there are Hasidic Jews who laugh with a sort of ha 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 ha. But never in all their experimentation did they ever come upon a single individual in any country who laughed with a multiple consonant. So you never hear anybody laugh ha ka sa ta ha fa ka ta ha ma ka ta ha ka ta ha ka. And I've been practicing. It's a new form of speaking in tongues. They also found that really hearty laughter produces endorphins. Endorphins that get you high. And the beautiful thing about it is that it can be fake laughter because the physiology is the same. So, you know, your body doesn't know that you're missing an insight here or two. It just gets... Life is a trade-off. And so when the authorities find out that... that you can get high just from laughing heartily, they'll start a program going to school saying, look, kids, if anybody comes up to you in the yard and says, want to hear a joke? Just say no. I guess I should talk about Bill Clinton. You know, there's a new generation now. He said that he didn't inhale. There's a new generation of younger politicians now who are saying, I did inhale, but I didn't enjoy it. So, you know, so step by step... it has to be done gradually. It'll probably come in through the side door. They'll legalize pot when it's used for medical purposes, and there'll be an epidemic of glaucoma somehow. I'm going to have to move you to the back. You're interfering with everybody else's timing. Now, do you think you can control yourself? Anyway, Clinton, I had such high hopes for him when he came into office, and yet he just kept compromising one thing after another. You know, he would start out and say, the Constitution does not allow for there to be prayers in the schools, separation of church and state. Then the Republicans start saying, you know, we got to have prayer in the schools, very important. So Clinton gets right in the middle and says, okay, we can have prayer in the school, but they have to pray that we can lick the deficit by taxing the churches. Just right in the middle. I mean, they can pray, but they can pray for safe abortions. And I think it came from excess masturbation that his spine became like strawberry jello. You know, and he'd go back and forth on positions. And that's really why he fired Joyce Lynn Elders, because he was personally guilt-ridden. Not as rumor had it, that it was part of his crime bill, the three strokes and you're out. The thing about Joyce Lynn Elders was that, you know, it was so innocent. I mean, the worst thing I've really heard about masturbation, I heard on KPFK, they said that when somebody masturbates, their IQ goes down 40 points. Is that so bad? I mean, it doesn't stay there. I have no idea how they did the research. I'm not sure if it was just reading skills or across the board.
Come on, step on it, Mudhead.
Oh, I'd love to, Porgy, but I got my two tones through the floorboard already.
Well, okay, then we could take the shortcut through Frogtown.
All right, we could stop off at Pop's and dig some jugs.
Some what?
Oh, that Louise Wong's got a balcony you could do Shakespeare from.
Aw, not now, Mudhead. They need me at the last meeting of the Philatelist Club.
I didn't know you masturbated.
Aw, creepies, Mudhead. Where's your school spirit?
That's in the rumble seat. You want to snort?
Oh, very funny.
Sure is.
So that was Joyce Lynn Elders. You know, all she said was that it should be taught in schools, and it should be. Guys could learn from masturbating how to avoid premature ejaculations. I say guys because women don't have the problem. You know, somebody says, aha, you just had a premature orgasm. A woman can say, no, that was just my first. So, I mean, I would like to have serial orgasms myself. I would be willing to sign a pact. Is there a devil in the house? You know, if I could have serial orgasms, I would be willing to have a menstrual cycle. You know, 4 days medium to heavy flow, reasonably mild bitchiness. Just, I'll sign up. But, you know, so there are some things that make up for the fact that you only get 2/3 of the pay that a man does. Well, see, the thing is that men are fearful about premature ejaculations because with the system of going out on dates now, people have an investment. You know, they pay for dinner, they pay for a movie or a play, and then if they get each other in bed, the man wants a return on that investment, which is not to come right away. I mean, but who's to say? There are no objective standards to measure at what the precise moment is that a premature ejaculation becomes a mature ejaculation. I don't even know what a mature ejaculation is, but I think that Vice President Al Gore has them. He's just so relaxed, you know. I think that he takes his Prozac from a Pez dispenser. So he would have a mature ejaculation. He would say, Tipper, I feel some stirring now. I think I have a few spasms coming on. I just thought I'd let you know. I'd like to share that with you. Maybe wearing a smoking jacket and a pipe there. You don't hear much about Tipper Gore anymore. I think she's in the basement of the White House censoring lyrics. Yeah. Now they're up to gospel songs. Oh, look at this. Go down, Moses. We can't have that. Ouch. Get me that blue pencil. So, And yet, no matter how disappointed I am in Clinton, you think of the alternatives. I mean, just now, I think they're going to decide whose book sells more, Gingrich's or Colin Powell's, about who, you know, we wouldn't have to elect them. Just the bestseller list will be the one. And then we can just go to the poll to select our favorite pollster, the one we trust most. Let's see, Harris. I just blocked out all the other pollsters. Fields, Gallup, right, ABC, all of them, CNN. We'll just push the lever on the pollster that we trust most. Has anybody here ever been polled? No, boy, and you're a random sample, certainly. Everybody from my Rolodex. How random can you guess? So, all right, so there's Colin Powell now. I mean, I'm not sure what he's done. The only thing I remember is that he was the first African-American head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. But right away, he was fighting against having gays in the military. And he said, well, you have to realize that it would make the men in the barracks uncomfortable if a gay slept in the same room with them. And you want to say, well, now, wait a minute, General Powell. Isn't that the same thing they said about blacks? He said, yes, but we never told anybody we were black. So this was the forerunner of the Don't Ask, Don't Tell program. We had George Bush saying, read my lips. Now we have Robert Dole saying, read Mein Kampf. Yeah, just a jump away. And then Pat Buchanan, who talked about those terrible people who wear sandals. At the Christian Coalition, it was the first mention of Jesus there. I mean, even William Bennett says that Pat Buchanan is flirting with fascism. And for Bill Bennett to say that, because Bill Bennett is a real reactionary himself, so for William Bennett to say that Pat Buchanan is flirting with fascism is like Charlie Sheen deriding Hugh Grant for having to pay for sex. And Bennett, of course, Bennett is sort of like a friendly fascist, because, you know, he was a secretary of education, and then he was the drug czar. When I first heard about him, somebody said, what do you think of the new drug czar? I thought they were talking about a new drug called czar. And, you know, so Z-A-R. And I'm enough of a phony, I didn't want to admit I hadn't tried it, so I said, oh, yeah, czar, I've had that stuff. It's really, you know, it doesn't last as long as ecstasy, but, you know, it you don't find yourself gritting your teeth. I think it's, yeah, I want to get some more czar. You know where I can get some? So.
Dig the dead. Who are you?
A ragu of your memories and fantasies like all others.
Edgar Casey.
Over the edge now, Neil.
It's Neil Cassidy on the Sphinx's nose.
No, it's not. What are you on, Jerry?
It's that new drug, Tsar.
Tsar Nicholas, for your crimes against Russian people, you die!
I hear statistics, and somehow they stick with me. I try to block them out. Like, I heard a statistic that 14% of seagulls are lesbian. I don't know how they found it out or why they wanted to know. I heard one statistic that the average person lies 25 times a day. I thought, wow, I don't even meet 25 people in one day. So that means I have to include the lies that I'm telling myself. And so for 3 solid weeks, I watched everything I said to other people and to myself. We're really self-witnessing. And, you know, just every thought, just to test to see if there was any level of untruth to it. So I didn't really do that. See, that's a lie. I just made that up, see? That's my 26th lie for today. And it's prorated, so the beautiful thing is that tomorrow I only have to tell 24 lies. So it'll balance out.
Oh, I see.
Who started at $5?
All right, let's I guess
go
it was me.
25, nice 25, going, 25, 25, 25.
It's all a fake, Mudhead. They lied to me.
Hey, what do you mean, they?
You know, them. Name three. Well, there's the pooper and you and me. Hey, whose movie is this? Yeah, it's nobody's now, Mudhead, because I'm getting out.
How are you going to do it, Porge?
I don't know.
How'd you get in here?
Darn, I don't remember.
Well, where were you before?
Before? Yeah. Right.
I sold the...
I want to give you something pragmatic that you can take home with you, which is a way of telling the difference between dreaming and reading the news, because it's getting more and more difficult to tell these days. And this has been going all over ever since the Reagan years when we had government by public relations. And so there were photo ops. For example, I remember Ronald Reagan and Nancy Reagan standing with Michael Jackson in between them. You know, because Reagan had heard that Elvis posed with Nixon, so he was trying to follow a tradition. And you begin to doubt your own perception, because did I really see that, or was that like a doctored photo on the cover of the National Enquirer? You know, so you need a way to tell those the difference between that. I remember when the Surgeon General, C. Everett Koop, took a pipe away from Mr. Potato Head as some part of anti-smoking campaign, I think. But I wasn't sure. I thought, okay, I've lost the ability to tell the difference. I no longer can tell the difference between a TV soundbite and an acid flashback. Just totally blurred. And so I needed a way to tell the difference, and I reverted to my childhood, something I discovered in my childhood. If you remember your childhood, it was very much like being a Martian and trying to learn how to be an Earthling so they wouldn't know. And because you don't know where you're getting your philosophy from, where you're getting the meaning of life. I used to listen to the radio, and the source of my inspiration was Mortimer Snerd, who was a ventriloquist dummy. Edgar Bergen was a ventriloquist, and he had two main dummies. One was Charlie McCarthy, who was like the city slicker, and he wore a tuxedo, and he had a monocle and a top hat, and he would make all kinds of obscure references. I mean, an obscure reference would be like, the artist formerly known as Prince has changed his name to Ruth Hirschman. And his country cousin was Mortimer Snerd, who, you know, was dressed in overalls and a plaid shirt and had scruffy hair and freckles and buck teeth with a straw in his mouth. He all talk kind of goofy. So one time, Edgar Bergen said to Charlie McCarthy, "Charlie, what are you doing?" And Charlie said, "Nothing, Bergen." And Mortimer Snerd said, "Well, then how do you know when you're finished?" And it was like a Zen koan from the mouth of a wooden dummy, and affected my life totally. Anyway, so one time I went to Steeplechase, which was an amusement park in Coney Island, and it was named Steeplechase because around the perimeters of all the other rides was this track that went up and down, several tracks, and each one had a horse on it. And so it wasn't like the merry-go-round, which is fixed, because, you know, the horses are impaled to the carousel, so they always know what order they're going to come out in. But these, by pelvic thrusts, you could make your mechanical horse go faster. And you could see the ocean and the beach. And my brother and I used to go to the beach first because we were obsessed with pubic hair. And sometimes, this was before bikini wax. And so we would like to walk around the beach because it was just so taboo. We wanted to make sure it was there. And so we would kind of walk around the beach and see a woman who was sunbathing. So it wasn't rude because her eyes were closed anyway. But there'd be a few little curlicues sticking out of the crotch there. And, you know, I'd say, "Hey, come here. Look there. It's one." And we felt as if we had a productive afternoon. I mean, it's changed now. You know, I mean, you get a copy of Penthouse, you open it up, the pubic hair falls out on the floor, mixing with the subscription cards. So you can see the ocean and the beach and the other rides, the boardwalk, the tilt-a-whirl and the whip that, you know, went around fast. And this was before they had lawyers for whiplash cases, where they would have had a ball there just standing outside the exit gate. And then there was an indoor arena, which had a stage at one end of it. And it was like a little theater. They had lines of seats there where people would sit and eat their lunch. And they had other rides inside there. They had the Dodge'em scooter cars. They had one which was operated entirely by centrifugal force. You would get in this round thing and stand again at the outside of it, and it would start spinning around faster and faster. And suddenly you would notice that the floor was dropping, but you were still plastered to the side because you were being held there by centrifugal force as it's going around and around faster and faster. Which was not a good ride to go on if you had just had French fried potatoes and a Coke and a malted and a hot dog. And so you're suddenly feeling a little nauseated, and you have to, again, timing is very important, because if you throw up while you're under, it'll come right back at you. So just at that moment when you sense the bile, you just turn your head quickly to the right, shoop, splat, and it goes on to somebody else. One of the tricks of the trade there. So the thing about the stage area is that people come out this door, regular people, and they come into like a miniature funhouse on that stage. And there's things that come out of the ground and at you, and there's you walk over, and this platform is jiggling. And then there's a platform you walk over, and there's a hole about 1 inch in diameter, out of which comes this air spout. And so when a woman walked over it, it would blow up her dress. And if she didn't have a bathing suit or panties on, there would be this flash of pubic hair, and the audience would applaud. And this was before Women's Lib. And so I was offended by it. Even though I was obsessed with the pubic hair, I didn't think this was an appropriate way to see it.
Jóvenes chicanos in white tees or rayon shirts tight and open, dungarees, walk down the beach in threes, drink bud, and look at pussy.
And worse, if a woman was smart enough to know what was going on and she went there holding her skirt down, there was a clown. It was a dwarf wearing a clown's costume. With hostile makeup. He looked real angry, and he had an electric cattle prod. And so if a woman was walking by and she held her skirt down with her hands, he would buzz her in the buttock with the cattle prod. She would let go and scream the air, and her dress would blow up again. And I was really offended by this. And, you know, my parents had told me to act normal, and I was in search of normality. And this was presented as normal. I mean, there was an audience there approving of it. So what I didn't know was that the steeplechase ride, when you come off of it, you go down a ramp and you go in, out this door. The exit door is the entrance door to the stage. So when I came out, I realized, well, this is like a captive performer. There's an audience there waiting to see us go through this funhouse. But I noticed that the dwarf in the clown costume was leaning by the front rail talking to somebody in the front row, and his electric cattle prod was right next to him. And again, this is a moment to decide something very quickly. The left lobe of your brain is very rational and says, if you buzz that dwarf in the clown costume with his own electric cattle prod, it will change the dynamics of your particular encounter. And your right lobe, which is pure impulse, is saying, how can you resist it? You'll be on your deathbed and you'll regret you didn't do that. So in that moment, time freezes and the left and right lobes of your brain fuse, and choice and impulse become the same process. And so you have your retrospect in advance. You know that you would feel better if you had buzzed the guy, and you still have the opportunity to do it. And that's just in a split second. So I buzz the dwarf in the clown costume. He jumps up in the air, and the audience starts applauding because he got what he had done to so many others. And I hadn't counted on this. He started cursing at me and throwing his fist and chasing me all around, you know, around the cotton candy stand. And it's a very dreamlike experience. Being chased around an amusement park by a dwarf wearing a clown's costume who's mad because you buzzed him in the ass with his own electric cattle prod.
No, don't trust that dwarf. Come in. I'm the strange Dr. Weird. Just entered the vault of mindless fellowship.
And so I didn't, you know, and see, this was before Fellini. So I didn't have a metaphor. I'm just running there saying, boy, this is like a.
Thank you.
But the one thing I knew was that you could tell a difference whether you were dreaming or awake by flapping your arms like wings, like this, because I had tried it in my dreams and I could fly. So I knew it was a dream. So this is what I what I took with me back into my adulthood on how to tell the difference between watching the news on TV and dreaming. I remember when Bob Dylan became a born-again Christian, and I thought, wait a minute, didn't he say don't follow leaders? And now, so I flapped my arms like wings, and I remained stationary. So I knew it was true. Bob Dylan had indeed become a born-again Christian. He's going back to his Hebraic roots, of course, but he's currently in a halfway house for secular humanism. Because can only do these things step by step, very gradually. You know, it's like the Unabomber, for example. Where are you? Stand up and take a bow. I know you're going to be here tonight. Come on, don't be bashful. You there in the ski cap. Come on. The most bizarre... I flapped my arms for this one. The Unabomber said that he wanted his 35,000-word article to be in the New York Times or the Washington Post, or, as third choice, Penthouse Magazine. But since that wasn't reputable, then he would do one more bombing and kill one more person.
Dropping those bombs again. Never wanted to. Dropping bombs on you. I can't help it. Dropping those clowns on you. Winning World War II. What a thing to do. Can't take it. Dropping those bombs again. Dropping those clowns again. What could we two do? Winning World War II. I will bury you.
Oh, no, I shall bury you.
I can't take it.
I flapped my arms for that one. Because I never thought that we could have a serial terrorist who had such a sense of moral values. So Bob Guccione, the publisher of Penthouse, sends out a message on the internet to the Unabomber, ignoring the fact that the Unabomber is against technology. And he says that you should realize that we reach many millions more than the Times and the Post combined, and that we reach just the kind of audience you want to reach, which is a bunch of college fraternity brothers jerking off in a circle, having a circle jerk. I don't know if they still have circle jerks now that they have the World Wide Web. It's sort of a universal jerk. But a circle jerk was guys used to do it. After feminism came in, women used to do it. So, but it was delayed equality. Guys would sit around in a circle and masturbate, and they would have a goal, like to see who came first, or who came last, or who came furthest. And
engines! Pull the wagons up into a circle!
Why do you always do that?
We get better reception that way. Do you mind if I put this antenna up on yonder peak?
That's our sacred mountain.
This is our sacred antenna. It's shaped like a cross, made out of aluminum. Got any aluminum?
We've still got some corn left.
Hey, corn, now we can make whiskey.
We've been waiting hundreds of years.
We just invented a Tom Collins.
Here, engine, you want some fire water?
No. We were warned by our elders not to drink anything that would make us weak or silly.
Put it in their well.
That's not a well. It's the eye of the holy serpent mound on which you're standing.
It's a butte.
No, it's a mound.
And right purdy, too.
I mean, when I did that, there were only a couple of guys I could find to do it. So the three of us sat there. It's more like a triangle jerk. But what you could learn, you could really learn. I learned an important lesson. It was what turned me against nuclear testing. Why I protested every nuclear test was because masturbation and nuclear testing are very similar. You want to test the equipment, and then once you do, it's gone. So you have to do it all over again. You had to have another nuclear test. Recently, I needed it again, more and more often. I had to flap my arms like wings when I learned that the National Association of Talk Show Hosts was awarding G. Gordon Liddy an award for the First Amendment Award. And I flapped my arms for that one. I didn't fly, so I knew, okay, they're doing it. They're giving it to him. I mean, and this was after he had said that this was about the ATF. If the ATF is going to raid you, you better know that they wear bulletproof vests. So aim for their head or their groin. I mean, I guess that's not quite yelling fire in a crowded theater. But it's strange because, you know, Liddy got started in his career. He was a very strange guy. He stuck his hand over a flame to impress a girlfriend, and she was impressed. Before that, he was Gordon Liddy. He did that, she said, gee, Gordon. That's one of the little-known secrets of his... Gee, Gordon Liddy ate a rat in order to overcome his fear of eating rats.
When you can't stand the pace in the big rodent race, come on in where it's safe, where the menu is trained. There's a smell in the air that reminds you of hair. You've got something to get, and it looks like your pain. Some rat parts and fry them up real nice. Then we skin the kitties and barbecue the mice. Guts in a cup, yum! Mouse on a stick, wow! French fried fleas and beer battered tits.
Rat in a box.
We fry what you want.
Rat in a box.
We fry what you want.
Rat in a box.
We fry what you want.
I mean, that's a nice direct approach. None of this gestalt shit. So, I mean, I don't know how he had it, you know, if he had it like he barbecued it on a spit, turning it over, or chopped it up with mushrooms and tomato, ratatouille. I have no idea. So the thing is, then he had arrested Tim Leary. That's how he got his start in 1960s, mid-60s, early 60s, at Millbrook Estate up in New York, where he was doing his research on LSD. And then he used that. He was then an assistant DA of Poughkeepsie. And he used that as a career move. Then he became got the FBI, the CIA, the Watergate burglars, served a prison term, came out, rehabilitated, was last seen holding hands with Betty White on Hollywood Squares, and then got his own radio talk show. You know, the epitome of the American dream. And yet he went around with Tim Leary debating. 16 years after he arrested him, Leary and Liddy were going around debating each other on college campuses. And I went to one of the debates, and during the debate, Leary said to Liddy, you know, Gordon, I will eat a rat if you'll eat a hash brownie. So Liddy turns him down, because you can only carry machismo so far. But the Psychedelic Liberation Front found out about this, and they got schedules of their debate tour, found out which motels that they were going to stay at, fed hash brownies to some rats, and dropped them off in the motel rooms that Liddy would be staying at, figuring that sooner or later he would feel like a midnight snack after a... after a heavy debate, and would suddenly see this thing rush in front of the fireplace, grab at it, and you know, it's just on the borderline on the ethics of dosing. So the ironic thing is that if Leary had taken Liddy's advice when they did that midnight raid on his research headquarters of shooting in the head and the groin, then Leary would have been on that stage debating himself. But Leary's nonviolent. I just talked to him recently. I guess you saw in the papers about a week ago that he announced he has inoperable prostate cancer. But this has given him a chance to talk about death. He loves to talk about death. And so he's very cheerful. I mean, people react to diseases. A friend of mine found out she has cancer, and she says, I just want to live to see the apocalypse.
Armageddon came to dinner, and nobody remembered his name. He sat at the left of the host, uncomfortable, ignored, eating celery and glancing at an empty mirror which hung opposite his place.
So, you know, people, it forces them to understand what their value priorities are. This is what Leary told me, that they can clone. They'll have the technology in the future to clone tissues from just the head to reproduce a whole person. So he's considering that. He hasn't made, you know, I mean, if that doesn't work out, they'll use his head for celebrity bowling. They'll just go right down there. So many friends have died lately that you have to develop a callus and see the absurdity and the tragedy at the same time. When Jerry Garcia died, I knew that he wanted to be cremated, and I thought, okay, what they're going to do is they're going to mix his ashes in with some really good Colombian marijuana, roll it in joints, and then the members of the band and some few deadheads who won a lottery would sit around, you know, smoking Jerry. But I was sad about his death, but I was angry too, because the dead used to eat really good, wholesome food that they had catered to them, but Jerry just, you know, he smoked cigarettes and he ate a lot of junk food, and his artery was just like a pinhole wide. That's how clogged it was. So, you know, in that sense, there was a level of suicide to it. So there was an anger about that. He didn't have to do it. You know, everybody had their own reaction to that, too. On Venice Boardwalk, there was a huge scroll that people could sign things on. The favorite one I saw was, it just said, Jerry, say hi to Linda. She'll know you. So it was just, you know, just like a little leap of faith. And last year when Kurt Cobain died, I had the same feeling. I was sad because he was a new force in music and because he left behind a wife and a kid. And I was angry because he had committed suicide. Again, you can't say what somebody else's level of pain should be, but nevertheless, you thought, you know, maybe he could find some other way, something that would help him. You know, a codependency support group, which is my favorite oxymoron. But something. So his wife, Courtney Love, also shared that same sadness and anger and had the empathy to know that at a memorial, that the fans who were mourning him and grieving also had a little bit of that anger mixed with their sadness. And so she led them in a chant going, asshole, asshole. You know, not the usual behavior you find at a memorial. And then Jerry Rubin died. Now, first I have to mention it because we're doing this in Santa Monica, and there's a local Jerry Rubin who runs the Alliance for Survival. And the one who died was Jerry Rubin of the Yippies. But he moved from New York out here and heard that there was a Jerry Rubin here who was a peace activist and was egotistic enough to think that this Jerry Rubin named himself after that Jerry. So he called him up to have lunch and asked him to bring his birth certificate with him. And so Yippie Jerry offered Alliance Jerry $10,000 if he would change his name, $20,000 if he would change it to Tom Hayden. So again, I was sad because, you know, Jerry left behind two kids and an entire pyramid scheme. And I was angry because, again, it didn't have to happen. He was jaywalking on Wilshire Boulevard across six lanes of traffic. I mean, he spent the entire decade of the 70s exploring his consciousness, and then he forgot what he learned in kindergarten. You know, cross at the green and not in between. So it was just frustrating on that level. Even when Nixon died, I had a mixture of sadness and anger. Sadness whenever any member of the human race dies, you know, they did not end up the way they started. So he was really a tragic figure. But I was angry because I remember at his funeral, they were lauding him so much, praising him to the... You would have thought that they were having a saint there. I mean, that's what people who watch CD-ROMs in the future of his funeral will think. They have no idea. So I identify with Nixon because I read once that he had a difficult time saying, I love you, which I did too, which a lot of men in this culture have. They just, it's just part of the repressiveness, very subtly, of the taboo of expressing by words the emotions that you feel. Because I would try it. I would try and like on Mother's Day once, I said to my mother, I really love you, Mom. And she said, ditto. Because she came from a repressed culture too, you know. So, but I saw on David Letterman's Stupid Pet Tricks, there was a dog who could say, I love you. I mean, it couldn't articulate it like we can, but sort of howled it. Iravu! And so I would like to have told that to Richard Nixon. You know, Richard, just say, Pat, Iravu! You know, she'll understand. It's a step. In fact, every conversation I had with my mother now, on the phone, I could say that to her. I could end the conversation with, and Mom, Iravu! And she would say, ditto!
My wife, Nancy, wrote down just a two-word thing, and it was moral imagination. Mm. And I think that that's what's going on now, and I like it.
Good. Great way to end. Thank you so much, Paul.
Well, it's mutual, you know.
We'll do another one next year, and I love you very much.
I love you, too. And I don't usually say that because I said it to my mother once, and she said, ditto.
All right, later.
So I would like to have been at Richard Nixon's funeral and have a reconciliation. You know, Richard Nixon, I forgive you for smearing Helen Hagen Douglas as the start of your political career. I forgive you for framing Alger Hiss. I forgive you for cheating at the Price Support Board. I forgive you for extending the war in Vietnam. I forgive you for dropping bombs on the children's hospital in Cambodia. I forgive you for invading Chile. I forgive you for having Allende slain. I forgive you for the Watergate cover-up. There's just one thing. Where is Courtney Love when we need her? Asshole! Okay, let's see.
Mind if I turn on the radio?
In a massive traffic tie-up, as the death rate continues to soar. Now, let's go to the River's Edge and Charles B. Smith.
Ed? It's an amazing scene here. Like lemmings, the crowds are waiting on the shore, torches blazing as the long line of shrouded funeral rafts drift lazily into view, great black candles flickering at helm and stern. The excitement is contagious, and so are the Black Cross volunteers as they pass from family to family, pausing now and again to touch a child's head. I wish I could... but I can't. So long, Ed.
Thank you, Charles. And now here's another feature in our continuing report on the...
Hey, Mac, what'd you turn it
off
for?
How close are we to the border?
Well, at this rate... Uh-oh, I think they spotted you.
I wanna die! Touch me!
Can't we go any faster? There's too many of them. What can we do?
I don't know. Throw him your coat!
Throw me the gun!
Here's the border up ahead.
Thank God.
No, not yet. We'll never make it through that crowd at the gate unless you do exactly what I say. Take off all your clothes.
What?
Come on, buddy. Take them off.
Right.
I know. When I give the signal, toss them out, and I'll drive this heap right through the barrier. Ready?
Yes. That's everything.
Okay. Here we go.
It's very important sometimes to just quietly sit back and not even ask yourself questions, but just try to figure out some very simple things, even without words. For example, we're talking about death tonight. And we take for granted, and I suppose rightly so, because being the kind of creatures we are, we have to take about 99% of everything for granted, but we'd spend most of our time out of action, just being amazed and wigged out by how perfect and really uncomplicated the whole thing is. But one question that comes to mind is, why are we born to die? Why death? I mean, we take for granted, as I say, right? That, you know, you're born, you die. You grow older, you mature, you die.
It's only a way of looking at things, old
man. Yes, I know, but it's a way that seems to happen to everybody. We find it faintly amusing.
Give me immortality or give me death. That's the motto here at Ralph's Ball Sports' new and used body shop in the city of the future. Hi, friend, Ralph's Ball Sport here to tell you that everybody must die, but you don't have to be there when it happens. That's why we're having a great going out of body sale. Yes, you can live forever while your friends fall apart around you like rotten fruit, and here's how. Lease an organ or limb from our headless body farm. It's made in America. Americans, enter the new century with these exclusive clone-ons. Nap velour designer jeans, deluxe follicle hair mat grafting with upgraded media-sensitive stimulated wrapper filler, rear roll, non-glossy carbon intensified glute guards, power moons, and tinted tint grill spoilers in slash dash or faux flannel. So come on down to Ralph's Ball Sports, City of the Future, and do it today, because there may not be a tomorrow.
When certain wealthy movie stars try to preserve their youth, they try to look 30 when they're 60 or 70 or 80, and one day they go up in front of the mirror and lift the shade and it's gone. You know, man, I'm 85 years old and I'm still thinking like a 30-year-old. I don't know what to do. You know, they say, grow gracefully into old age. Yeah, that's a bummer also, I'm sure. Everybody's got an idea on how to die, but nobody sits down and asks, why death? I mean, why? What is there specifically natural about somebody being, you know, being born, growing, maturing, and dying? Why does there have to be this thing called the end? Now, most people are scared of dying.
Oh, come on now. You can't scare me. I'm not afraid of death anymore.
Shut up!
We're not talking about ego death. We're talking about body death.
I don't think I could rightfully say that I'm not one of them, David.
No,
you know, think about it. It's not even dying violently, which is something we try to escape by putting it in all of our movies and television shows. That's okay for the guy in the black hat on the black horse, right? But not me. It's not going to happen to me. I'm going to die. And in the war movies, you ever played the little game of trying to find out before the first reel is over all the guys are going to get killed? But it's the guy that always says, I got this lucky piece, Charlie, and as long as I got this lucky piece, nothing can happen to me.
What did you do with your lucky piece?
I left it back in the barracks. That's it. He's gone, right? Nothing happens without a reason. That's the way I feel. And I feel that there has to be a reason for death. I think death is kind of an interesting, kind of funky phenomena.
Shoes for industry.
Shoes for the dead.
Shoes for industry.
Hi, I'm Joe Beats. Hey, what chance does a returning deceased war veteran have for that good-paying job, more sugar, and the free mule you've been dreaming of? Well, think it over. Then take off your shoes. Now you can see how increased spending opportunities means harder work for everyone. And more of it, too. So do your part today, Joe. Join with millions of your neighbors and turn in your shoes.
For industry.
I was in New York recently, and I've lived in California since 1971, and I realize now that I've been forced to become mellow from the aggressiveness in New York, because where I live in Venice Beach, I don't drive. I don't drive a car. I don't even have an automobile license, so I don't even have an ID. But I can walk everywhere in Venice. I can walk to the post office, and the clerk is very friendly. He says, have a nice day. I walk to the laundromat, and then it's my turn. I say, have a nice day, and they say, you too. You know, everybody knows their parts.
The places you go in daily life, in your bachelor life, you know, you go out there and you take care of the laundry. When in Santa Fe, it was a place called Shockey's. Great name for a laundromat, right? Shockey's. Washing with Ava. Oh, I must say, before I get into this. Thank you. All the machines had names on them. Washing with Ava and Gladys and Desi, warm women wrestling my underwear clean, and Viola, Maria, Jolene, spinning the sheets, rinsing the left behind panties, softening towels, plenty of permanent press for Indian bambinos, free steamer for such young little mothers. Oh, ladies, I promise to stay with my clothes at all times. To look for lipstick or crayons or, God forbid, plastics, pen, grease, gum, or etc. Fading and bleeding are due to the dyes, not your machines. Send me the woman who'll bleed on my sheets and then help me fold them.
But in New York, it's like it's much more crowded and people are kind of protecting their space and they don't look at you in the eye or smile much. And I went into a grocery store and got some goodies and the clerk, she doesn't even look up at me. She just rings up my purchase, and I said, okay, my mission on Earth today is to cheer her up. Because she's just sitting there looking sullen. Who knows why? So I said to her, aren't you going to wish me to have a nice day? She looks up. She says, it's on the fucking receipt. And I looked. And it was. There it was. It added up my prize and said, have a nice day. I kept that. It's not like when somebody says it to you, you know, and it just fades into the ether. But when you have it in black and white on paper, you can get up in the middle of the night and just pick it out of your... Have a nice day. Thank you. It works every time. I was in New York. There was a conference at Town Hall about Lenny Bruce. And I was on the panel. They had Lenny's daughter and Lenny's lawyer, Nat Hentoff from The Village Voice. And they had me, because I had edited Lenny's autobiography. And they had Richard Lewis, the comedian, in order... Not, he had never met Lenny or seen him work, but they needed a drawing card to get Town Hall filled. So he's talking about Lenny. He's going on and on and on. And again, it was time for me to surrender to an impulse. So when he finished, I said that Lenny's dying words were, please never let Richard Lewis ever talk about me. So he's pretty neurotic to begin with. But now you go, now I'm confused. Wait a minute. What? He didn't say that. And so later on, he's talking about how Lenny opened the gates for performers to speak on a stage as they would in their living room, and that people could now say P-U-S-S-Y and C-U-N-T. He spelled it out there. So later, when it's my turn to speak again, I felt that I said, Richard, I have to reassure you. Lenny really didn't say that on his deathbed. I just made that up. But it was just so easy to tease you. You're such a good target, but you're really a pussy. And you know, it's just handed to you. So, but I was also in New York to promote my autobiography, actually my unauthorized autobiography, which I wrote it against my better judgment. And I didn't cooperate when I was doing the research. I kept my files locked. Told my friends not to talk about me to my face. And there's things you find out about a book, because you don't just write it. You have to deal with the lawyers from the company, and then you have to promote it. And the lawyer was a woman in her late 20s, and so there were different cultural references. And the job, you know, so every proper name in the book, she will ask a question about, you know, and I learned that the magic words was deceased. If somebody's dead, they can't sue, because that's what they're worried about. There was a thing I wrote about when I did research into the Charles Manson case and learned that there had been pornographic videos and films taken from Sharon Tate's loft by the L.A. Police Department. And they were selling these then. And I got these from a private investigator, this information, who had sources in the LAPD and the individuals who were selling them. So I didn't do self-censorship. I just put in the manuscript every name that he told me. So where it, he had said there was Sharon Tate together with Steve McQueen. And she, deceased, no problem. There was Sharon Tate together with Dean Martin. And she says, well, Dean Martin is still alive. Barely, but, you know, there's a definite line there. It's not like a premature ejaculation. He said, okay, we'll call him Sharon Tate and a popular singer. I don't know how popular he is, but that was to distinguish him from a rap artist. So then there was an orgy of Cass Elliot together with Yul Brynner, Peter Sellers, and Warren Beatty. Picture that, if you will. And so we're reading off the names. You know, Cass Elliot, deceased. Yul Brynner, deceased. Peter Sellers, deceased. Warren Beatty, look, she says, he's still alive. We can't take a chance. He's trying to improve his image. He's married now. He has a couple of kids. I'm saying it's not my responsibility to worry about Warren Beatty's image. You know, he was a womanizer, and he never seemed to be ashamed of it. But, you know, I couldn't argue with him. So now in the book it says there was an orgy, a film of an orgy of Cass Elliot from the Mamas and the Papas together with Yul Brynner, Peter Sellers, and an actor who isn't dead yet. which I like better, actually. Has a nice rhythm to it. And I'm not making any judgment, any value judgment at all about pornographic films. My favorite movie was a porno movie. It took place in a barn, actually, that had been had a stage and rows of seats, and it was sort of like summer stock. And it had haystacks against the back of the stage, and there was a beautiful buxom blonde woman there and a donkey. And as she was disrobing, she was arousing the donkey. And this was nothing sleazy. There was Beethoven in the background. And so when she's fully disrobed and the donkey is fully aroused, the blonde and the donkey start copulating against the haystacks at the back of the stage, very slowly and sensually, and the camera pans over the audience, which is filled entirely with donkeys. I think it was one of the demands of the animal rights people. Food and shelter is not enough, they need culture. So to promote the book, that was the other part of it. To promote the book, I was going to be on the Conan O'Brien show. And I'm on at 1:25 in the morning, right after the bruised fruit fight, when they have maximum viewers. But it's taped in the afternoon, like at 5:30, something like that. And I had to go downtown New York to a reading. And so NBC provided a limousine for me. And I come out of the building, and there's the limo with the driver waiting, and there's a few people gathered around because they figured a limo outside of NBC, there must be a celebrity. And also it was mentioned in the papers that morning. So I get out there, and this woman comes up, and she says, "Do you mind if I pose with you?" I said no, and this guy with the camera is taking a picture. We put our arms around each other because a camera gives you permission to put your arm around a stranger. And she says, "Thank you very much," and I walk away. And a man comes up and asks her for her autograph. And now I'm in the limo looking out the window, and she's signing an autograph. I don't know if it's her autograph or mine. It's just like I saw this photo. They had this Elvis convention, and a woman was getting an autograph from an Elvis lookalike. Yeah. Was he writing his own name, hers, Elvis's? I don't know. Why would she go back with that? Look what I got. It's from an Elvis lookalike, in case her friends don't trust her. "Oh, you never met an Elvis lookalike. Come on. No, look, here's the signature. Look, it's just like Elvis's." Okay, I believe you. I'm sorry I ever doubted you. So, okay, so back to the book. There was one scene in the book I described where I had gone to Egypt when the Grateful Dead played the pyramids, and I mentioned that Bill Graham gave me a marijuana cookie backstage, and she says, "Does Bill Graham approve of your saying this?" I said, "Well, he approved at the time, but he's deceased." And she says, no, he's not deceased. I said, "I just went to his memorial in San Francisco. Bill Graham is deceased." She thought I was talking about Billy Graham. So, you know, but that's fair. You know, yeah, you don't know your references. You can't take references for granted. I mean, there are people who think that Abby Hoffman is the congresswoman from upstate. You just don't know. So now in the book it says, "Impresario Bill Graham," just so people will know. But, you know, the day that Billy Graham gives me a marijuana cookie backstage at a Grateful Dead concert in front of the pyramids, the revolution will have been won. Let's see, I want to talk about political correctness a little bit, because it is so getting so prevalent on every level. I think the epicenter of political correctness would be Eugene, Oregon, where they have recycled toilet tissue. I mean, that's really environmental consciousness. And recycled toilet tissue is tan. It's a nice tan color. And the first time I was there and I saw tan toilet tissue, I flapped my arms like wings. And I didn't fly, but I heard the voice of Mortimer Snerd say, "How do you know when you're finished?" It was just a little scatological reference there. At Antioch College, they have a politically correct dating code where you have to verbalize whatever is going to happen between you sexually. And so you'd think perhaps it spoils the romance. I don't know. Maybe articulating is more romantic. Who's to say? But their handbook is sexist to begin with because it has the male being the aggressor asking permission of the female for each thing that's going to go on instead of it being a two-way path. So they have, you know, the guy says, do you mind if I stroke your lovely hair? And she says, no, please go right ahead. Would you like to hold hands? Okay. Mind if I rub my finger in that little crevice there, that little web-like crevice? Okay, no, that feels good. Go ahead. Oh, can I kiss you on the cheek? Sure, go ahead. Can I kiss you on the lips? Okay. Can I insert my tongue about half an inch? All right, half an inch. Can I rub the tip of my tongue along the ridge of your gums? All right, that sounds like fun. Do you mind if I fondle your breast? No, that's okay. Can I lick your nipple around the areola there? Well, okay. And so I don't think you have to ask. If you get permission for the left breast, I think it also applies to the right breast. If not, it would give new meaning to the concept of double jeopardy. Even in the culture, in the movies now, Berkeley is politically correct. When the movie The Fugitive played in Berkeley, the theater was picketed by a group of one-armed men complaining that the one-armed man in the movie The Fugitive was played by an actor with two arms and that there were plenty of one-armed actors who could have played the part. And so they went around, each one in a picket line, every other one had a placard that they were holding up. So that freed the other ones to go, what do we want? And when do we want this? So then there was a movie, Silence of the Lambs, which had negative stereotypes of gays. And so the radical gay group ACT UP picketed that theater. The same thing with Basic Instinct, had negative stereotypes of gays. So ACT UP not only picketed the theater this time, but went along the line of moviegoers telling them how the movie ended. There was, when JFK played, again, negative stereotypes of gays in that, ACT UP picketed that, and once again, they went along the line of moviegoers telling them how it ended. Yeah, he gets killed, yeah. Yeah, the government got away with it. Yeah, and the CIA, yeah. The FBI, yeah, the mafia, right, Cuban exiles, absolutely. Well, but, you know, who had most to gain? Oliver Stone. And so, you know, I believed in conspiracy until I saw that movie. There was a scene in JFK. It was a black and white scene. Takes place in the Texas Book Depository. Not on the sixth floor with a rifle leaning against the window, but in the cafeteria. And there's Lee Harvey Oswald waiting by the phone booth for his CIA connection to call. He goes over to the authentic Coca-Cola machine, puts a coin in, clunk, down comes the authentic Coke bottle, and he walks away, drinking the Coke, never taking the cap off. So that's the fatal flaw in that movie. The conspiracy theory goes right down the drain. I now believe that Lee Harvey Oswald acted alone, with one hand tied behind his back, while he was picketing The Fugitive.
We interrupt the Late Late Show to bring you this bulletin from the KWKWT TV newsroom. This late word from New Orleans. The jury has returned a verdict in the Kennedy assassination trial. Former Louisiana Governor James Garrison has been found guilty on all counts. His attorneys will appeal the decision directly to the war president's spiritual advisor.
For those of us who are part of a triple generational syndrome where we have offspring of our own, at the same time we're the offspring of our parents, you can see there's been an evolutionary jump in child rearing. So, for example, my daughter Holly could say to me, "Oh, Dad, that's trivial bullshit." I could never say that to my parents, and nobody knew could say to their parents. It was just, and my parents specialized in trivial bullshit. And the way I learned to deal with it was just to pretend that my parents were a Buddhist monk and nun, and they were there on Earth in order to test my patience in trivia. And so when I looked at it that way, I would go to the house and they would say, look how many electric outlets we have in the kitchen now. I would get excited. I would say, oh yeah, there's one, there's one, there's one. Look, there's a three-pronger. And it made them feel good, I feel good, there was no friction between us. So there was a way of dealing with that then. You know, if my mother, I would be eating a sandwich, my mother would come from the end of the sandwich, facing her, open it up and put more food in. And I would, you know, I would marvel at this, something new to contemplate. Was this in her home economics course or was it genetic? I had no idea. My father gave me a parka for Christmas. He showed me how to put the hood on. He said, okay, now, here's a hood here. It's sewing on right here. If there's a sudden gust of wind, you just go like this, right over your head. Now, I had a choice. I could have said to him, Dad, look, I'm not 5 years old anymore. You don't have to act like a frozen TV dinner stuck in your parental role. I could have said that, or I could have said what I did do. I said, Dad, let me practice a few times. And so it opened up new areas of intimacy. And he put his arm around me and said, I'm real proud of you, son. You're a fast learner. I want to show you now what to do. Let's say you have the hood on. And there's a sudden warm spell. You just reverse the process like this. Whereas my daughter gave me for Christmas, she gave me a pair of red cotton long johns. Where I was working at a theater upstate in Sebastopol, where it's cold and clammy in January. And I wanted to show these red cotton long johns to the audience. So I unbuckled my belt, pulled down my jeans, and the red cotton long johns stuck to my jeans. Now, there's another very dreamlike moment that you're on a stage in front of a group of people and you're displaying your bare buttocks and there's a spotlight on you. Now, you can't flap your arms because they'll think, what is that guy, the human bellows? Didn't we see him at the sideshow? So I had to do it very subtly and didn't fly. So I knew it was a reality that I had to deal with. So I just said, oh, it's my impression of Reverend Moon. And they thought I did it on purpose. And that was. But I got such a rush from doing that I wanted to try it again. So I would do it only once in each new city because I didn't want it to become a comedy gimmick. But you don't know what kind of repercussions had. Because when I moved from San Francisco to L.A., and I could walk anywhere in San Francisco, but L.A. you really need to take. And I had an early morning appointment, and there were no buses or cabs in sight. And so I started hitchhiking, and I see a car coming. I get out in the middle of the road with my thumb out, and I see it's a police car, and they have a megaphone saying, pull over to the side. I look around, and they say, we mean you. So I pull over to the side, and these two cops give me a citation for hitchhiking. L.A. is such a car town, they only have citations for automobiles. So where it says make of auto, they put down ped for pedestrian. Which says approximate speed, they put down 3 miles an hour. Yes, Your Honor, I was going 3 miles an hour in a 35-mile-an-hour zone. I'm sorry. So I give them all the information, and they said, let's see your ID. And I say, well, I never carry any ID. And the officer says, well, why not? And I said, well, because I know who I am. Which I thought was a reasonable, succinct answer. But I had lost my empathy for that woman. At the moment, I realized that I didn't see it from the cop's point of view, which was that I was being a wise guy. So I wanted to do something to reconcile this tension between us. And I knew I had an ad from the Los Angeles Reader in my pocket for a show I was doing. I thought, my name is there. I'll give this to him as quasi-identification. But before I could hand it to him, I realized that the photo of me, and that was me mooning an audience. And so, you know, again, you have to make a quick decision. The left lobe of my brain says, well, you know, if you hand that to this officer now, it will change the dynamics of this. Don't forget, he's the authority figure, and you are in a... My right lobe was saying, how can you resist? You know, you'll be in your next life, and you'll still have an urge to hand some photo of yourself mooning to an officer. You won't know why. You'll just... So, again, it's as if time freezes. The left and right lobes of your brain fuse, and you have your retrospect in advance. You realize that you would regret it if you didn't do it, and you still have time to do it. So I handed it to the officer, and it was worth it. I mean, I used to try a lot of weird drugs in the 60s, but I never got a rush like I did at the precise moment that this officer, out of sheer habit, looked at this photo of my ass and then at my face and said, "Is this you?" These are rare and precious moments. I mean, these things you remember.
Police state!
Police state!
Police state!
Help! It's the police!
Policemen, real policemen, it's policemen will become.
Who's number one?
Peacemen, yes, we're peacemen! Even though we wear a gun,
it's all in fun.
Police state, where green rookies become hardened men in blue, where danger wears a diploma and crime gets taught the lesson it deserves. Listen now as the Federal Bureau of Marijuana, in cooperation with Crime Lord Magazine, presents challenge number 13, Roach Patrol at Police State.
Hate cops, Guido. I always hate cops.
Yeah, Nick. I hate cops, too.
Yeah, me, too.
I'll tell you guys what I'm going to do. I'll tell you what I'm going to get. Even with every rotten cop in this city.
Yeah, me, too.
How you going to do it, Nick?
How are you going to do it?
You know what I'm going to do?
No. What you going to do, Nick?
I'm going to turn in my badge.
Yeah, I'm going to burn my uniform.
I guess I have to talk about the Oklahoma bombing because it was such an incredible shock. And yet, you know, every once in a while, you know, with the trial again, we'll bring it up. But, you know, you think about that and you think about the odds. For example, Timothy McVeigh got caught. Now, Timothy McVeigh is a guy against the government. He doesn't want to have anything to do with the government. He doesn't want to have a driver's license. He doesn't want to have a license plate. He got caught because the license plate from his car was missing. You know, like, wait, who's writing this script? The other guy, Terry Nichols, again, a guy who hates the government, refuses to pay taxes. They caught him because they found a 6-month-old receipt for a couple of tons of fertilizer. You know, now what was he saving the receipt for? He's not going to pay his taxes. Is he going to... Is he going to go back to the store and say, "I'm sorry, the fertilizer didn't work"? And then as somebody, his job, his mission in life was to determine that a leg that was found in the rubble of the federal building did not belong to a white man, but to a black woman. And furthermore, that leg was planted in the rubble by Detective Mark Furman. You'll see that in tomorrow's early editions. So here's my theory about the case. And everybody knows, you know, there was this guy in Florida who said that Cato Kalin and O.J. Simpson did not go to McDonald's. They went to Burger King the night of the killings and bought some amphetamine from him. Cato testified that they went to McDonald's and then in the Rolls Royce. And on the way back, that O.J. was eating his Big Mac, and Cato waited till he got back to the maid's quarters or wherever he was staying, and he ate his Big Mac. Now, nothing was ever listed on the police reports about their finding any McDonald's wrappers in the trash can in Cato's room. Nothing was said about whether there were any McDonald's wrappers in O.J. Simpson's Rolls Royce. So if the defense was smart, they would have plea bargained so that he would plead not guilty to murder, but guilty of littering, where he threw the wrappers out of the car. But I tried to contact them. I just couldn't make much contact.
One of the other people who was born in July, mm-hmm. Is the infamous O.J. Simpson. A lot of fun, not, man. Not he Bart killed. Simpson.
I love that show, The Simpsons.
Yeah.
That's
well,
great.
In recognition of O.J.'s birth, I would like to present a poem, O.J. Obviously jealous old jock, overly juiced, off-hours junkie. Ornery, jazzed.
Overheard jabbering outside June.
Ominous jawing, offensive jamming.
Uh-oh, jeopardy.
Overpowering jabs, on target, jagged, one-on-one.
Just overkill, geez.
Odious justification.
Obscene Jezebel, Occidental Jew.
Obituaries. Joint.
Odd joyride, overexposed journey.
Outlaw jacketed, obedient jailbird.
Oriental judge.
Ordinary jury.
Only jerks.
Oscillating jurist.
Obdurate Jeanette.
Outrageous jargon, overtime jumbo.
Objection.
Justified.
Oath sworn Joneses.
Obfuscating jesters.
Obtuse jousters.
Obsequious jugglers.
Others, jackasses. Obese jawmen. Officer Judas.
O.J. Jamboree.
Overwrought journalists.
Overrated jackals.
Option, junction.
Off.
Jail?
Overlooked jurisprudence.
Our justifications outweigh judgment.
Justice?
Overruled.
OJ's out.
Jesus.
Ouch.
Joke.
Hey.
Hey, memories.
Memories are made of this. OJ lives.
Okay, good.
Whatever the defense and the prosecution do in that case, and the judge and the media fallout is the thing that is not talked about enough. Because I have a friend who has two young daughters, and they said to him, Daddy, we have a question to ask you. If you ever killed Mommy, and we're not saying you would ever do a thing like that, but if you ever killed Mommy, and we asked you if you did it, would you tell us the truth? See, now, if this were on a sitcom on television, there would be a laugh track there. Because, I mean, that's really the lowest form of fascism is the laugh track. Because what is more individual than your sense of humor, and yet that tells you what they want you to think is funny. And it's not even it's dead people who laughed at I Love Lucy who were now on tape laughing at something else that they never even saw. And what it can do is, you know, it takes 3 weeks to reprogram your nervous system. This is what they found out in cults. And so I did an article for the LA Times, and for 3 solid weeks I watched sitcoms and heard the laugh tracks. And at the end of that period, whenever something was on television that I thought was funny, I wouldn't laugh until I heard the laugh track. I wasn't sure. I needed that permission. It had become part of my nervous system timing. And so, like, for example, I was watching the Donahue Show, and they were talking about how sex toys can help break up a marriage or bring it together, depending on what you did with them. Yeah. And so Donahue asked the question, burning on America's mind, what did the Old Testament have to say about vibrators? And so, you know, and I like you, I waited. I wasn't sure whether this was intentionally cued or whether it was a theological insight, you know? From Ecclesiastes, there is a time for manual dexterity, there is a time for vibrators. I'm going to give you one more chance. When everybody else was waiting to see that was whether that was funny, you were there laughing. You are a human laugh track. You are a console. But I'm not upsetting you, am I? Oh, I guess not. Okay, I certainly... No, but did anybody ever criticize you for laughing too much before?
Yeah, people in movie theaters generally say, oh, yeah, I heard you in the audience.
Oh, yeah, but that was Schindler's List. Okay, where was I? Let me give you one more example of how the laugh track affected me, because I was watching on CNN the live parole hearing of Sirhan Sirhan, and a woman on the parole board said to him, Mr. Sirhan, let me ask you a question. And he said, oh, please, that's not necessary. Call me Sirhan. And again, I waited because I wasn't sure. Was he trying to be ingratiating? Or cute? Was obsequiousness part of his religious tradition? I just didn't know. So, when I researched the Manson case, I actually believed with all my heart that there was an agent for Navy intelligence who posed as a hippie artist and programmed and orchestrated the killings. So, because I believed in that with all my heart, when I hear people now saying that, you know, it's really the government that was behind the bombing of the federal building in Oklahoma, I suddenly can identify with Bill Clinton. You know, I feel their paranoia. I can identify with that. But I do want to wind up the evening on with a sense of hope, because there's so much shit hitting so many fans these days, and which is a phrase, by the way, the shit hitting the fan, that didn't come into the language until after electricity. So it's not like, you know, some Japanese lithograph. The shit really hit the fan now. It has to be with electricity revolving so fast that it protects you from the shit. Or what's a fan for? So this is my favorite optimism story. It was a symposium that took place at the University of Kansas. And there was a panel discussion. On the panel was Ken Kesey, novelist and merry prankster, Ed Sanders, poet and leader of the Fugs, which was a band somewhere on like the missing link between rock and punk. Although there were some people who kept it in the classical section of the music stores because they thought it was the Fugues. Also on the panel was Max Lerner, a right-wing liberal, who had a book called America as a Civilization. And he was so megalomaniacal that he was underlining stuff in his own book. Writing stuff in the margins of his own book. That's so true, I agree. Also on the panel was a Latino professor who taught Spanish at the university. And so we're being kind of conspiracy-oriented and saying, oh, yeah, you think that's bad, listen to this. And we're on, you know, just getting worse and worse about the possible conspiracies that are making us so pessimistic. And then at the end of the panel discussion, there are questions from the audience. There's a microphone at the front of the stage, and people just walk down the middle aisle and ask their questions or make their comments. And at one point, down the aisle comes a dwarf who's crippled, and he's on crutches. And this was before the disabled liberation movement got as visible or as active as it is now. So there was a big tension in the audience. Somebody lowered the microphone to his height, and he starts lambasting the panel. He says, I don't like to hear that sense of negativity up there because I, for one, am an optimist. And he proceeds to explain why, that he's into networking in every form, personally, he reads alternative weeklies from around the country. He has a fax line that he gets immediate communication with Europe. He has a ham radio. He's on the World Wide Web, internet, everything, you know, in terms of immediacy and seeing what's going on that he doesn't get from the regular news. And he starts delineating the ways that people are fighting City Hall in creative ways, the people who aren't even political, whether they're having a food co-op or a rent strike or using barter instead of money. And so Kesey and Sanders and I look at each other. We realize this guy's right. We're not going to argue with him. By this point, Max Lerner is now signing his own book. And on the front page, he's inscribing to Max with unspeakable respect and affection, without whose hard work this tome would never have been finished. Respect, Max. Only the Latino professor gets out of his chair to confront this guy. The Latino professor walks to the front of the stage, points his finger at this dwarf, and standing on his crutches there, and he looks him in the eye and he says, so you're optimistic, huh? That's easy for you to say. You're white. And so whenever I begin to feel a little bit down, I think of that little guy and I feel better. But I must admit that when he first walked in, I thought that it was the guy from Steeplechase. I thought that he had fallen down chasing me, and this was finally my karma. Thank you. Et bravo!